We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And thanks for listening.
Well, here we are, Lauren. We're already in September, and we're recording this podcast transcontinental style.
Woo!
You're, of course, in London? No,
well,
LA.
I'm actually in LA now. Oh, yes.
You move so much.
As you know, we're a little behind this month on the podcast.
We are. It's been a hard month to just at least line up our diaries, isn't it?
Yes, it has. I guess it doesn't help when there's a few different time zones between us.
Completely different time zones, too. 12 hours we're talking yes. here, aren't we?
But yeah, I've just arrived in LA from London and it's very hot here.
Oh, it's cold here in Melbourne, so lucky you.
What about your travels, Nick?
Yeah, well, I just came back from Turkey and Greece, which was beautiful. I was so surprised by Turkey. It's a very modern, stylish place. I just didn't expect that. I expected more like a, you know, rough and tumble Cairo in Egypt, you know, that kind of place. But it was completely different.
It's quite continental, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like at the forefront of modern culture. It just is so well done. And, you know, there's areas, of course, that are a bit rougher, but it's got this beautiful metro lifestyle that's just buzzing. It's great.
Wow, that sounds very exciting.
Mm-hmm. And what have you been up to, Lauren? Now you're in LA, but you're London.
Okay, bit of a story. I started my trip a few weeks ago. I started off in LA and I was pretty excited about life and still am. I think there's a real tangibility to the industry here. When I arrived, unpacked, had a shower, headed out for coffee, and I met a guy pretty much right outside my door who was like, oh, where can I get coffee? And I said, come with me. So we went and had coffee together, and he's a film writer. And we sat there and talked about the industry. He's from New York, and, you know, it's so exciting to just immediately run into someone who I can sit down and talk about what inspires them, what their journey's been like. You know, the fact that pretty much everyone here is someone that you could talk to about those things, I'm sure that gets overwhelming at some point.
I was going to say, because there's two sides to that, isn't there? There's that side of, that's great, I get people to talk to, but there's also that thing of there is thousands upon thousands of people doing the same thing.
Yeah, which I suppose, for me, that's kind of fantastic because it's all about your perspective, right? Yeah,
great mindset to have.
And I just arrived so excited, which caught me out a few days later. But I ordered some awesome classes with Anthony Mindel and Lisa Robertson.
Uh-huh.
Both really different methods, but a great standard of acting, which is very exciting to see. And I just love the auditing system here. You know, there are so many classes to choose from. So you can audit a class at most of the studios for free. As opposed to auditing in Australia, where you pay to audit in a learning capacity.
Mm.
And obviously there are pros and cons to both. I did some burlesque classes with, you know, trying out new things, with the very talented Kat Lacoe, a.k.a. Vixen DeVille, who is a fantastic actress that I met the last time I was in L.A. What else did I do? I caught up with the host of the Inside Acting podcast.
Oh, that is exciting. Who was that you caught up with? Trevor or AJ?
I caught up with both of them.
Oh, no way.
Yes, I caught up with Trevor in LA. We had lunch. And then a few days later when I was in New York, I caught up with AJ. It was just so excited to meet with Trevor and AJ and, you know, they're both so lovely. Meet them in person, chat about what they've been up to, what's driving them in their individual careers at the moment, which obviously they talk about on their podcast, but, you know, to get to ask my own questions. and, of course, discuss the international joys of podcasting.
And what about New York? Did you go to New York?
Oh, New York was blissful. I don't know what else to say about New York. I saw a show. I just wandered around. It was really lovely. Oh, just quickly, the other person I caught up with in LA, I caught up with loads of people, but I just wanted to mention that I also had coffee with Ansuya Nathan, who does the Another Aussie in LA podcast.
Ah, another podcast friend.
Yes, that's how I make friends these days.
Other podcast people, very nice.
I mean, if you haven't already listened to her podcast, it's really interesting. She's originally from Adelaide. She's a fantastic actor and writer who moved to LA a couple of years ago and has been back and forth between LA and Oz since then for work. I would definitely, for any of our listeners who haven't already listened to her podcast, I would check it out. And then I arrived in LA and I shot some footage for a self-test with Bruce Alexander. I don't know if you ever worked with Bruce in Melbourne.
No.
But he set up the Melbourne Actors Studio in London, Melbourne Actors Studio in London, which I think has been running for about a year and a half. That was just a really great experience. So for anyone who's ever in London, I would recommend they check him out.
You've certainly filled your time, Lauren, anyway, haven't you?
Yes. Nice. I mean, there's been lots of other stuff, and obviously I'm back in LA and having a few more meetings and stuff before coming home, but it's just been a really fantastic month. Enough about me. What about you?
Well, I actually wanted to use this time a little bit differently because I have been touring around a little bit, and I just wanted to put something out there to the storytellers that listen to the podcast because it's something I've noted and been thinking about over a few podcasts, but it's come to light a bit further with my recent travels. Obviously, I had a trip to Turkey and I had a bit of a bucket list moment, which was visiting Gallipoli.
Yep.
And I think for Australians, there's something special about visiting Gallipoli. I think it had a lot to do with what was a young nation coming to terms with who they were. And sometimes that happens through atrocious things, you know, whether it be through war or whatever. We bonded as a nation through that Anzac spirit. Now, I have always sort of thought that my personal heritage or culture was quite limited. And I never really brought it to my storytelling because, you know, being such a young nation, and of course, yes, I've got an English and Irish background, but it's hard to make that connection because you've never lived there or you've never had that connection. However, when I went and visited Gallipoli, it was quite interesting because we've always heard the Anzac story. But what was quite interesting was the Turkish side of the story too.
Yeah.
And hearing that that was actually the start of their nation also, that Ataturk, or who was a guy named Mustafa Kemal, was one of the generals in that First World War. They named him Ataturk as the father of Turks because he was part of their revolution as a country. And this was what was inscribed actually on the Australian side, or the Anzac Cove as they call it, on the Australian side of the beach. And I thought this was quite poignant, so stick with me here. Those heroes that shed their blood and lost their lives, you are now lying in the soil of a friendly country. There is no difference between the Johnnies and the Mehmets to us where they lie side by side, here in our country. You, the mothers who sent their sons from faraway countries, wipe away your tears. Your sons are now lying in our bosom and are in peace. After having lost their lives on this land, have become our sons as well. And now what I took out of that is this idea that as storytellers, our culture comes from many different areas. And I felt a really beautiful connection to the Turkish country at that moment too, that through the atrocity of war, and even though they were enemies at the time, there was this friendship, really, really beautiful friendship between the two warring parties. And in fact, Turkey now considers Australia part of their culture and part of who they are as a country. And it got me thinking, right? Because I also attended a Welcome to Country at a recent conference, which was done by an Indigenous gentleman named Graham Briggs. And he talked about this idea of Aboriginal or Indigenous culture is linked to what we'll call white Australia. And he goes, we are intrinsically linked, and to move forward as a people, we need to embrace both our cultures and move forward. And it got me thinking. I started thinking as a storyteller, I always have shied away from thinking about what my heritage was because I thought it was so insignificant.
Yeah.
But it's funny when you add all that together that I really felt a real connection to my heritage being a part of the Turkish way, a part of Indigenous culture, all these things. I can bring them into who I am and who I am as a storyteller because they have affected me. And that's why I was thinking culture needs to be recognized more like the original meaning of the word by the Romans, which was cultivation of the soul through experience.
Wow. So yes.
I know that's full on, but I really, it all of a sudden said to me, right, there's so much more to my tapestry of my heritage and my culture than I originally thought. I just want to put that out there as storytellers, have a think about what your culture is and what are those elements of culture that have affected you as a storyteller. That's my thing I wanted to leave this month.
Goodness me, Nick.
That's a bit intense, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's just something to think about.
I love that. I feel like, I mean, it's interesting having had this separation from you this month.
Yeah.
You know, normally we're catching up in the weeks leading up to the podcast and we're a little late with this month's podcast. Mm-hmm. We just haven't had the same communication we normally do.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to sort of come together and talk to you. And it seems like I've had this month, I feel like my challenge has been to be as outward facing as possible,
mm-hmm.
and to be as open as possible. And so I've been following up on every connection and
yeah, getting yourself.
I was thinking about if I named my story for this month, it would almost be to be brave and just do it. That's sort of my little motto.
Yeah, nice.
But yeah, this real sense of turning outwards, and it sounds like you have been taking a lot on board and turning inwards.
Definitely. And so that's why when hearing your original story about what you've been up to this month, I thought that is so different to what I've been facing, you know. But that's the yeah. beauty, isn't it? That every
it's
month
wonderful.
It's going to be different for each individual. So
yeah.
I enjoyed hearing your stories, and I think we are so lucky to have our next guest.
Oh, yes. I'm talking about different things this yes. month. we're going to be talking to the wonderful Thomas Meadmore.
A fascinating fellow, and we did do it over Skype, this interview, so please stick with us. The first 5 minutes of audio is just a little rough, but still very, very, very good, but not to our normal quality. So please stick with us for those first couple of minutes.
Okay, here we are through the powers of Skype and the London Tube. Lauren lost her Oyster card this morning. Nick and I are here today with filmmaker Tom Meadmore in his house in southwest London.
Well, can we just say that you're in his house, Lauren, but I'm back here in Australia at the moment, so I'm looking at you via Skype. Tom, can you tell us a little bit about your house? Why did we choose your house as the venue as a storyteller? Does it mean anything to you as a storyteller?
I think probably it's two things. One, I have to be honest, convenience.
It is the wee hours of the morning.
It's 7:30 in the morning right now. I think, but the other thing is, when I'm not working, when I'm in between my freelance jobs, this is where I work on my own stuff.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you.
So to get started, do you want to read your story for us, Tom?
I was born in Perth, Western Australia, and moved to Melbourne when I was 13. I was a stoic child who worked hard negotiating a difficult upbringing. I took neurosis into adolescence and channeled it into writing creatively and eventually into weed. I loved stories and wrote poetry and scripts from a young age. Instead of concentrating in class, I would write. I would use any excuse to write. At high school, I discovered the video edit suite and began playing with pictures. And I'll never forget successfully timing a piece of music to start in sync with text on screen. I skipped classes to play on the edit suite, on the edit machine. I would find any excuse to edit. And this merged with my writing, and a passion to make films was born. Eventually, I quit weed and my work developed with a strong focus on honesty. The idea that attempting to take responsibility for my flaws brings about opportunity for real change, and that's exciting. Change is fundamental to a story. If I'm truly okay with my flaws and trying to change, I can draw self-esteem from the knowledge that I'm at least doing my best, and I would like to inject that into my work.
Great. So we've got a lot of questions about all
so
of that.
So many questions.
One at a time. It is 7:30. So to start off, how did you find growing up in Perth versus Melbourne? When did you move?
1995. God, we're going back to there.
Yeah, we're going to start right from the start.
Well, Perth was great. Well, Perth, the big difference was the weather. Perth's really hot, and every second house has a pool. And so we'd spend our summers swimming in pools. And I miss it now, actually. We used to play these games called Marco Polo. Do you guys play
Marco Polo? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I got so we bad. Do have some sun here. And pools.
But if it was just remotely warm, we used to go round to my mate Lee's place and just live in his pool. Perth's much quieter. It's, it's like a country town.
Okay, so how old were you when you moved? Your early teens?
13, 12, yeah. 13.
I guess you see Perth as a sunny place then. Mm. Does that mean that coming to Melbourne, you know, was not something you embraced? Or
no, I really did. It was kind of very, it was very, very hopeful. We moved because my mum had begun a new relationship with a man, and I was very, very hopeful. It was like the beginning of a new life.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's great.
So when did you first start to look into arts? Was that in Perth or once you got to Melbourne, as far as creative writing, whatever it might be?
When I was in Melbourne, I think. Oh, but I mean, when I started taking it seriously, I was in Melbourne. But I was always into acting and, you know, drawing and stuff like that.
Okay. Did any of your family members pursue any arts, or was it just something that you found?
As a career, it was just me. But, I mean, it's been in my family and nothing serious. Like, my grandpa was a brilliant pianist, but it was a hobby. And my mum's brilliant at writing and all sorts of different stuff, but she never pursued anything as a career.
Okay, but so the love of stories, per se, you know, you could well say that that's come from her.
Yeah, absolutely. And my dad is an astounding storyteller. He's one of those people that
you're right
around a dinner table with him, and he'll just go, right, let me tell you a story. And everyone will just shut up and listen to this great story. He's brilliant. Yeah, he's brilliant at that.
Really? Okay. Do you reckon you took a little bit of that from him as well, from what you do now, as far as your documentaries?
Possibly.
Yeah. And so I was going to say too, because, you know, just listening to your story and also doing the research on you, it seems as if a lot of your talents, whether it be writing, acting, and we'll talk a bit about that later, editing, whatever it might be, a lot of these hallmarks are of all the different skills that you need to be a great film producer. I guess where you led in your life, is that something that came from all these things come together? And do you feel like your path has always been set to do film producing, or do you think it could have gone in different directions?
I think it has always been set. I don't know if it was always film specifically, but it was always something doing something like this. Always some kind of storytelling in some medium. I don't think I was always 100% aware of exactly what it was that was going on, but I knew from a very, very young age that I was very aware of it from a young age of the drive to do something.
The way you talk about writing stories in school and any excuse to write, you know, was that a bit of an escape for you, do you think?
Yeah. It was like therapy. It was my way of dealing with my anxieties and, you know, my issues.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It also seems, you know, that's when you were a child, but now in your work, there's across a lot of your short films and the stuff that's on Vimeo, you know, there's this, and you've placed emphasis on it yourself, the idea of honesty and taking responsibility for your flaws. It's like through your work and your stories, there's a real effort to understand yourself.
The catharsis of that.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about acting, because it's something that wasn't mentioned a lot, I guess, in your story, but it is something that was an important part of your life, and you did do a little bit of acting as well in the early days, and you've got credits on IMDb. How did acting come into your life?
Well, I was a bloody show-off as a kid.
Right.
You couldn't shut me up, and people would say, I was always performing in some way or another, and so people would say, oh, you should be an actor. So when I was in Melbourne, I'd never really taken it seriously, although I thought I was pretty serious about it. And then a couple of guys at school when I'd moved to Melbourne, I discovered I had an acting agent. And I was like, what? And when I discovered the acting agent, it changed everything for me. I'm like, oh, man, that means, like, this is the way to get on TV and get these sorts of jobs. So I got myself the same agent. And,
You make that sound like a fairly easy process. Yeah. Oh, I heard about agents, so I got one. And then I was on TV.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it was... It was a case of I went and auditioned in this open audition call for the agency, and they put me on the books, and I did a lot of extra work, lots and lots. I was probably, 15 or 16?
Did you train as well? Was there some acting training in there?
No, and this is the thing, nothing really formal. I did lots of classes, little bits and pieces, but I never went to like a proper acting school. I always thought that I kind of always had this opinion that I was pretty awesome and didn't need training. So I was kind of genius and I don't know if that's fair. That's the truth. I thought I was pretty awesome and didn't really pursue it until I was at the end of high school, and then I went to try and get into one of the proper acting schools. And then through high school, actually, once I got my acting agent, she often said, you need to, you know, keep training up and stuff like that. So I did lots, actually, from about 15 or 16, I did lots of weekly classes at the local, there's a school drum with a difference and Verve Studios, and I was involved in these sorts of classes. So I did do some training. I did do some training, but nothing like NIDA or the Victorian College of the Arts.
Formal theatrical training, sort of
a highly recognised training. Yeah.
And so, I mean, you have quite a few credits. You've got Neighbours. You've got Blue Heelers. Mm. There's a couple of other roles on there.
Mm-hmm.
So, was that a big part of your life to turn your back on?
To turn my back on.
I don't know if you want to talk about how you sort of moved from you. I mean, your credits, you've got heaps of credits on IMDb. You've got loads of editing and production credits as well.
Mm.
And, you know, they start in the same period from the 2000s and obviously increase through to the present day. So that's, if I was to look at you just online, that to me would seem to be your focus. Can you talk about how you shifted from acting and more into those roles?
Well, I was doing acting professionally, if I can say that, since I was about 15 or 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really serious about it. Always have been really serious about it. But when was it? It was 2005, I think. I remember having a conversation with my dad. He came over to Melbourne because things weren't going very well for me, and he and his wife were worried about me. I was living on my own. I was smoking heaps of weed at the time. Can I talk about that? Is that all right?
Definitely.
Hell yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's gold. Yeah, bring all the sex, drugs, rock and roll. Bring that shit in.
Yeah.
That's what we're all about. That's what
I don't know if you saw the brief, mate. Sex, drug and rock and roll was all about for the actor storytelling. Don't worry about that.
And a little footnote saying if you could make stuff up if necessary.
Yeah, so that's
pat it.
Pat
it out.
Yeah, that's right.
Feel free.
It's all about the story.
Feel free to lie. So... Dad came over with his wife, Corinne, and I was smoking heaps of weed at the time, and I just finished making this short film called Stairway to 11, which...
Catchy.
and it's actually not a bad little film, you know, but I considered it to be a failure simply because it didn't get into the St Kilda Film Festival. Right. And
the make or break St Kilda Film Festival.
I tell you what, as a short filmmaker, right, there's a couple of film festivals in Australia. If you don't get into them, you are a failure.
Shattered, right?
Yeah. I can appreciate that. Like, I have quite a few friends who, I mean, it's such a great festival for short films. So,
It's massive. It's a massive thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I thought I was a failure. But it's actually a good film. It's a good film. Anyway, I'd spend all my money making it. I was broke. And my dad said, Tomo. He sat there and he asked me, if you want to, you know what he said? He suggested I sell my edit suite in order to make the money back. And I said, you've got to be joking. And I got into this big discussion with him about it. But one of the things that he said that really stuck with me, he said, Tom, you're trying to be a writer. You're trying to be a filmmaker. You're trying to be a cameraman. You're trying to be an actor. You're trying to be an editor. He said, put your finger in one pot. Yep. Focus on that.
Isn't that interesting?
Get the soup really, really, really tasty and then use that. I added that soup bit. Don't know if he said that.
Yeah.
I like the pot soup analogy.
You like
the
analogy? Yeah, you said make get it really, really good and then use it as a stepping stone to do the next thing. And it just made sense to me, you know.
Such great advice.
It was really good advice. So anyway, at the time, okay, so that, as a result of that, he said, okay, how do you make money? You need money. You've got a skill, it's editing. At the time, I had done lots and lots of editing, lots and lots. It was the most I had done out of anything. And he said, right, you're a good editor. You can build on that. That's the most formidable skill. So I'm just trying to remember back. So I then set out to get a job as an editor, and I eventually found a job. I joined the Screen Editors Guild, and I found a job working for a small production company in Port Melbourne and was humbled. You know, I took on a job as an assistant editor, even though at the time or prior to that, I thought I was above an assistant. So it was really about humility. Humility has played a big part of my life.
Mm.
I'm experiencing it right now in my life.
Really?
Which is a whole other story. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's so interesting, though, particularly because, you know, at that point you'd done acting and you said you did some training, but you wanted an agent, you went out and got one, and then you started doing work on television. And, you know, it is that thing where it is so hard to really say, you know, one person will say this person's an amazing actor and this one isn't.
It's very subjective.
You know, it's so subjective. I guess editing, you know, any art is going to be subjective, but I guess there are more quantifiable things about editing skills that, you know.
Yeah. Well, I was very quick. I'm very quick at it. So yeah. I think that's something that immediately sort of made me employable.
Yeah.
So, and I was just able to do it. So,
and there's something really nice in that too, going, that's something that I know that I can do.
I can do
that.
Yep.
I still struggled with confidence.
Mm.
But yeah, absolutely. And then that's where it shifted.
What's the confidence thing about, though? Because is that something that you feel is just, it makes you a better editor? Like, is it one of those things where it's actually just you judging yourself and going, this is where I need to be better at what I'm doing? Do you know what I mean? Are you looking at that as a lack of confidence, or are you looking at that as something that I'm striving to be better?
No, I think it's been a case of, I think that's what it is now, Nick. But back then, and this has been true of anything I've tried to pursue creatively, at the start, I haven't fully believed or known that I've been good enough in order to do it as a profession.
Yep.
You know, it's the same with this film that I've just made. You know, I'm only just starting to feel like I know kind of what I'm doing and I could do this as a job.
Yeah.
You know, up until now, like the whole, I mean, I don't know if you saw the film, Nick, but through the whole thing, I'm going, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
But you know what? It's so funny, but that's where I found a real connection to you, because I think everyone feels that, don't they? At some point, about what they're doing with their life. Like, I was looking at you going, I've had those same things in the middle of the night where you're just going, what the fuck am I doing with my life? You know? So I think that was a connection for people watching the film into you as a person. You know, because we all are like that.
Which is what it's all about, right?
Mm, yeah. Exactly.
So, let's talk about the doco, which came to life when you were encouraged by your boss, Tony Jackson, at Lonely Planet, to take the plunge and make your first film. Though this is around about the time that I would have met you, Tom, when you were working at Lonely Planet.
We can do whatever you want.
Do you want to talk quickly about how you started working at Lonely Planet?
Well, it actually works in quite well. So after I'd worked at this small company in Port Melbourne, Catfish, for about 18 months, I went freelance. That was a big, big thing for confidence. I needed to really believe in myself to sell myself for companies around Melbourne, which was hard. But I did it, and it worked, and I was fortunate, and Lonely Planet became one of my clients. And Lonely Planet were making travel documentaries, and I got along really well with the team. And eventually we got along so well, they created a position and offered me a full-time position there to work on, to direct and produce all their short-form content.
Yeah, great.
Which was amazing, which is really, I actually didn't know that. Tony told me that recently at Splendor. He said, oh, we actually created this position for Tom. And I'm like, Well, far out. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that's how that job came about.
That's fantastic. And it must have been great. Sorry, I know we're meant to be talking about the doco, mm-hmm. but you must have edited some pretty amazing footage in your time with LPTV.
The best thing I can say, and this happens a lot when I'm out with friends, is I can talk about pretty much any city in the world as though I've been there.
Even though you haven't.
Been there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Did you ever get to go on location? Was there any...
No.
No. Just edit room, white room, that's it.
Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, back to the film really quickly. One of the concepts that you explore within it is evolving a passion into a profession. Mm. How do you personally navigate this with what you're doing now? We're asking the really simple questions, as you can see. These are easy questions to answer, right?
It's really hard, Nick.
Yeah.
If you like, we can move to the next easy question and, you know, give you time to think about it.
Yeah, have a think about that one.
I think it's a real short answer.
Yeah.
And that is just keep going. I think that's the only answer I can give you. It's hard work and you just keep going.
One step ahead.
Yeah.
Keep moving
forward. Just don't give up.
Yeah.
Just don't give up.
Okay. Well, so with this idea of keeping going, and maybe this answers this, but one of the things the doco looks at, you know, is what stops us from pursuing our dreams, specifically how fear can stop us.
Yeah.
So with this idea of keeping going, you had quite a few obstacles to overcome to make this film happen. Can you talk about how you kept going? I don't know how many of those you want to talk about. Like, I don't want to spoil the doco for anyone who's watching it.
It's all right. You can talk about it as much as you want. I think the obstacles I had to overcome were personal ones. A lot of self-doubt. I think that's the main thing. A lot of self-doubt in stuff. But also, you know, as you guys could see, I've had some problems with the way I handle certain situations in my personal relationships. So I've had to learn a lot about boundaries, and I've also had to learn a lot about sensitivity and tactfully dealing with people that I care about. So I think they're a bit twofold, really. But keeping going, do you know what I thought to myself, guys? I thought, if I stop, I'm never going to finish anything. I just knew it. If I don't at least finish it, I'm never going to finish anything. I have to finish it, and it has to work.
Mm.
And I thought, and it was, it's been, I have to say, it has been a nightmare. Part of the process, a big part of the process, has been extraordinarily difficult. And it's just that thought has kept me going.
How do you think, and I know that the process is still happening, but how do you think you will be able to let go of this project? It's taken up a big chunk of your life, hasn't it?
Oh, Nick, you have no idea how pertinent your questions are to my life at the moment.
Right. I can just feel it within you now that this has taken up such a chunk of your life. How do you let it go? How do you be at peace with it?
Oh, I think I am at peace with it.
Yep.
I think what I constantly wrestle with is it's very difficult because it's my baby. And what I wrestle with now is my expectations.
Yeah.
My expectations of what's going to happen with it, whether people will like it or not, my fear about whether or not people will like it or not.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're a little backwards in coming forwards here. You've spent years of your life working on this doco, and Nick and I have spent some time researching you and it, and we've both watched it. But we haven't mentioned to our podcast listeners what the doco is actually about.
Yeah, yeah.
So just before we go further with... asked about the obstacles you had to overcome and what you've learned from it. So just to go to the beginning again, can you just give us the quick blurb on...
Okay, so the film's called How to Lose Jobs and Alienate Girlfriends, and it's essentially about two musicians, Tony Jackson and his band, band Speed Orange, and Amanda Medica, a singer, solo singer-songwriter. Both of these people and their journey to turn their passion into a profession. And subsequently, my journey making a film about them, because Tony was my boss and Amanda was my girlfriend, how the relationship subsequently collapse as a result of the film. That's basically what it's about.
Okay, great. Now we can continue.
Okay.
So it took you 5 years to make this film, and you shot about 600 hours of footage. And one of the things that anyone who watches a film realizes is that you started out to make one film. Halfway through, you were like, what am I making? And then you took it in a particular direction.
Mm.
But I guess I'm really interested. You have a lot of experience in editing, and I'm not as familiar with that as an actor. You know, when you're in the edit room and you've got that much footage and you sit there and look at it, are there a number of stories you can still tell at that point?
Oh, yeah. I've got so many versions of this film.
Really?
I can't... Oh, you have no idea.
So you've... Okay, that's fascinating. And so you've chosen the one that says... If you had to break down what that film is saying, and so I want to know what it's saying and why you chose that story to tell with this footage.
Oh, epic questions. All right. The thing is, you have to understand... Please interrupt me, you guys, because I am renowned for my very long-winded responses to questions, right? I take myself really fucking seriously, so... So I think people give a shit about the origin of the seed of the moment, right? So basically, one of the things that I've learned is when you're making a film, only the most compelling stuff ends up on screen. So it's essentially about trying to determine, well, looking at the most compelling stuff and going, okay, well, what kind of a story is here based on this on that most compelling footage that I have, and marrying that with my internal, whatever it is inside me that I'm trying to say, and try, like, how can I get those in sync? And I think that was one of the most difficult things, because for a very, very, very long time, I resisted making the film about myself. And the film became about me in the edit suite. That's where it became about me.
Right.
And my journey trying to make the film. After all, I had a huge amount of conflict with both the people in the film, including my ex-partner. And when that conflict was at its height, I realized that the story that needed to be told was my story, trying to negotiate these relationships.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it was very difficult for me to come to that point. But the most compelling, it's always the most compelling footage. It's the most compelling, dramatic stuff that ends up.
That's what I wanted to ask. I guess I only found out a few years ago. I was talking to a documentary maker who was trying to get funding from a commercial station, and they were talking about how you needed to have the arc of the documentary planned out before you started shooting to get the funding to then go and shoot it, which was a revelation for me, because I kind of assumed, you know, you shot all the footage and then you found the story.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's a generalization to say every documentary is made the same way.
Mm.
But I guess watching your film, I wanted to know how much of it you... Did you shoot any of it after you decided what you were shooting? Like, did you go, oh, this is... Did you shoot all this footage and then go, this is the story I'm going to tell, and then you go, oh, well, I need some more footage like this to get to that? Or is that just me being very naive?
No. I mean... None of it's contrived, if that's
past. I don't mean contrived so much, but I mean, if I had extra footage when I say this, that'll help make that point.
There was 600 hours worth of footage, I believe, so that's
fair. Like, we need another 10.
No, not really, to be honest with you, no.
Because you were so many roles in the making of this doco, did you ever have any level of distance? Did you ever have anyone that you brought in and said, can you please look at this and let me know if... I'm just going crazy, or is this good, or what? Was there any people that you brought into the mix to help?
There was. For the most part, I was on my own, and I think that was one of the most difficult things about it as well, because having no perspective is really difficult.
Yeah.
But when I had the cut to 2.5 hours, I got a friend of mine, Duncan Barnes, wonderful guy, to come and have a look. He's a TV producer here. And we sat, was it 2.5 hours or 4.5 hours? I think it was 2.5 hours. And we sat down and watched the 2.5 hour cut. And he, I remember he stood in this kitchen with me, and I was terrified of what he was going to say.
Fair enough.
Absolutely terrified. Like, I can't tell you how vulnerable. It's one thing to edit someone else's film or to edit a TV show or something like that. But when you're sitting there showing someone your work.
I think as actors, we can
Yeah, and there's total level of honesty with this that is showing yourself, isn't it? It's like being naked in a room and going, hey, what do you think? That's what you're basically doing with this. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And I remember him standing here in this kitchen right there, and we were making, I don't know, soup or something to have a break. And he looked at me and he said, it's amazing. And I just went, oh, really? And he goes, yeah.
Fantastic.
It's And that basically opened up this sort of conversation about what was working. Because a lot wasn't, but the fundamental of it was there. And then from there, two other friends helped me, Rob Cromwell and Andrew Locke helped me pare the film down. I needed a lot of help paring the film down and getting it to 70 minutes.
You know, well, they say you should never edit your own story, right? Because you can't be objective about it.
You're so close to it, yeah. So you came to a final edit, and then you had a debut screening at Nova Cinema in Melbourne. And then you went on to Australia's largest winter music festival, Splendour in the Grass. I mean, that must have been exciting. What was it like to have it shown in those forums?
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Terrifying. But amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah. Like, how big was the audience at Splendour?
It was modest. It was modest. We were competing with First Aid Kit. Have you ever heard of First Aid Kit? Oh, they're an amazing duet, yeah. The audience that was there had a very strong response, very strong. Right. But it was a 500 seat room. And
when we say modest, that's still...
Well, it wasn't 500 people, so it wasn't a full house. We didn't have a full house.
Yeah.
We did have a very, very strong response, and it was absolutely terrifying at the same time. Yeah. Both the Nova screening and the Splendour screening went well, and it was really, really encouraging. It was really good.
I want to ask some questions about distribution and where you go next with it.
Yeah.
However, before, I keep wanting to ask another question about, you know, you mentioned Duncan, who is your friend here in London and who you've been working with. In terms of the timeline of the film, you shot all this footage and then you went, I'm moving to London. Like, or you were moving to London anyway and you continued the work. Like, how did that all pan out? Why did you decide to move? When did you decide? How far through the process did you decide to move?
In 2010, I went to France to edit the film at my dad's place. I went for a long holiday to spend time with Dad and edited a huge portion of the film. And the story, I didn't know this, but the story was still going on. Because when I got back to Melbourne, I had a huge falling out with my ex-partner, and subsequently she, you know, the film changed, well, my journey changed direction again. And I'd planned to move to London anyway. And the following year I'd moved to London and I found myself here. I moved here for work, to spend time with Dad, for the adventure, all that sort of stuff as you do as an Aussie going to London. I'd met a new girl as well, Claire, who was another motivation. And I was sitting here in London going, what am I going to do with this, all this stuff, all this footage? And that's when I realised that the story was about me as much as it was about Tony and Amanda, and I realised that was the story that I needed to tell.
And so what will happen next in terms of distribution?
Well, we don't know, do we? I mean, basically, we're in the process. We're currently talking to a couple of distributors in Melbourne, and there's a good chance we might get a short cinema release at the Cinema Nova. Fantastic. But it's all hearsay at the moment. I can't give you any definitive responses. The other thing we're doing is obviously the film festival circuit. So we're waiting. We've got a number of festivals that we're waiting to hear back from. So it's all just sort of up in the air at the moment.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting. Our previous podcast guest of ours, Natasha Pincus, I think that was podcast 6, who wrote the feature film Fell, which Casimir Burgess shot, which is just screened at MIF.
Yeah, yeah.
This month at ACME, you can see it. I think it's $10 a ticket, but simultaneously you can view it video on demand, so you can see it online, which is a really interesting
way of doing it.
Method of distribution.
It's here in London a lot. You'll see Posters on the Tube, released in cinema September 22nd and on VOD.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah, it's happening here a lot. Yeah, okay. Yeah, a lot. Right.
Yeah, you're not seeing it a lot in Australia at the moment, are we? But that's why Fel, I think, was so... When we spoke to Casimir as well in a radio interview a while back, he was like, oh, I just wish people could see it on the big screen. As much as I love the idea of releasing it and getting it onto people's computers, he said he shot that so that it could be on big screen, so he really would love if people got into the cinema and saw it. But I guess he said it's another form of getting your work out there, even though it's not in the original intended format. So this idea of distribution is very interesting about what avenues filmmakers take.
Well, yeah, I think audiences' viewing habits have completely changed as well.
Mm.
And I think online is a massive medium, VODs. I mean, I watch pretty much all films on VOD, pretty much.
Yeah, 95% of them. Yeah.
Anyone I've recommended to view Fel this month, I've said, find the biggest television you can.
Really? Is it really cinematic like that?
Yeah, right. It's fantastic. I'd definitely recommend it. Anyway, back on track.
Well, I was going to say, too, you know, if we sort of rounded up and said, okay, that doco's done and dusted and moving forward, as you were saying before, one step in front of the other, what's the next step for you in filmmaking? Is it another doco? What are you thinking? Is it too soon?
I'm very open to doing another documentary. For a long time, I wasn't, but now that this is finished and I feel a very, very positive sense of completion, I would absolutely do another one. Do you know what I've been doing? I've been making these little short films at work.
The Inner Fangirl?
Yeah, have you seen them?
Yeah, I wanted to ask about them, actually.
Did you see them? I love that one. Love it when that happens. It's great.
Great, well, continue.
Which one did you see? Did you see the Razorlight one?
Or
the Ella Jones one with Deacon Blue? Did you see
Watched the one, the glamour of working in TV.
Was it with Penn and Teller or with the Jersey Boys?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so basically the company I work for, they record a lot of live TV in the studio downstairs, and there's a TV show called Weekend, which is like a variety show, chat show with musicians and stuff. So we've always got celebrities coming through the building. You know the rule in TV is when celebrities are around, you've got to be cool. It's like, yeah, whatever. You know, you've got to be... And I'm like, fuck that. Fuck that shit. So I went. It's all happened really sort of organically. I went down to the Jersey Boys were in the building. I'm like, oh, musical's wicked, and I just videoed myself on my iPhone. Ended up making this fun little movie. Sorry about the banging, by the way.
So we've got some background noise here.
Yeah. Some construction happening outside.
So I made this fun little movie about my reaction to the Jersey Boys coming, and everyone in the office really had fun with it, really enjoyed it. So I've made a few more. And essentially, it's just this little really, it's a behind-the-scenes kind of very raw behind-the-scenes look at what happens to, behind the scenes of a TV show. But really, it's about the experience of someone reacting to their favourite celebrity or their favourite musician or whatever.
So where can we check that out? Where's the best place to have a look at that?
Go to. You can see them on my website at gofishfilms.com.au or Google Inner Fangirl. And there's a few there. Check out the Razorlight one in particular, which is my favourite. It's really, really...
I just think it's a really great idea. You know, we talk a lot about creating your work, and there's various people I'm talking to back home about, you know, and I know you've been talking to Scott and your other friends, Nick, about creating web series, but you get so caught up in the idea, it's great to just grab a camera and to get started. That's what I really liked about, you know, they're quite good quality.
Mm.
I mean, I would expect that from you.
Well, I think they're not bad for an iPhone film. You know, they're shot on an iPhone with no sound. It's literally just an iPhone.
Yeah.
You didn't realise that?
I didn't realise that.
It's literally just an iPhone. That's it. You know, so, and but I mean, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? Because, and this is very much actually how... My How to Lose Jobs Now and That Girlfriend started is it's literally me picking up a camera, and which in that case was one of my flaws, was literally picking up a camera going, okay, I need to make something. I need to make something now, you know, and just filming whatever based on my gut.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how that sort of evolved. And when you don't have, and I struggled with that because I didn't fully understand the craft of storytelling and all that stuff, which... Well, forgive me for sounding like a wanker, but this in a fangirl thing is the same thing. It's just me picking up the camera and going, oh, what can I make out of this? And it's evolved.
It's really interesting that you talk about picking up a camera and going from your gut, and that's how your documentary started out. And then it took 5 years to come back to going, oh, that's right, the story is about me.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting
full circle. Yeah.
Talking about picking up a camera and just getting work done and all your edit stuff and making it happen, that's that end of the process. If we look at the other end, you know, you managed to drum up a huge amount of publicity for how to lose jobs and alienate girlfriends.
Yeah.
I get a bit dyslexic with that title.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about how you managed that?
I came across a phenomenal publicist. I wasn't going to do it myself because it's a job within itself, publicity, and it's sales, really. It's sales. And a friend of mine, Monique Grumby, was on tour at the time, and she was doing really well. And I asked her about it. She recommended a publicist, basically. Emily, sorry about all this banging. This is why we love London.
it does sound like someone's trying to demolish the house while we're in here.
Yeah, it's inspirational. This is why.
Yeah, that's it. This is why Atmos. This is why we get the Atmos of where you work, so we get a feeling of what you deal with day to day, which is obviously banging on the roof, is it, basically?
Yeah, pretty much. It's the flat above us doing God knows what.
Yeah.
So basically I thought I was always going to get someone, a friend of mine or whoever, a PR person to contact media and try and get publicity for it. And I came across a brilliant publicist, Emily Chung, who on the map PR, and basically pitched her the film. And I'm so sorry. I don't know what they're doing.
Is this anyway, the sex, drugs and rock and roll? Is it sex upstairs? Is that what's happening? Just the banging?
You have no idea how often they... You have no idea how often they have sex upstairs when I hear it. I'm not kidding.
There you go.
I hear touching the whole on the big thing. Issues.
Yeah.
I love moments of lying in bed just listening to the bed squeak and the banging up against the wall, and I'm like, oh, now they're done. Okay. All right, so
anyway,
we're just going to have to suck it up.
Did we finish the point about Emily?
We have to suck it up. So anyway, so basically I pitched her the idea and she loved it, and she saw that it was had great potential, you know, for media to pick it up, and they did. And I'm not sure how this process works, but, you know, the media outlets don't just pick everything up. And then, yeah, just sort of the media who she contacted had a really strong response to it. And so we've got a lot of people still waiting to do a story on it for when there's a release. There's a huge number of people, radio stations and stuff like
so
that
good.
Want to do something, but wouldn't, and this is why what I was worried about. They didn't, because there wasn't a national release. You'll find with publicity, they want a date to talk about.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What's interesting, I think, you know, it's in the end, it's such an authentic story, and I think that's what people like, to tap into that stuff. Particularly in everything these days is about being able to connect to each other. I'm sure that's always been the case. But, you know, if you look at branding for acting, and it's not just can you act, people want to be able to reach you on Twitter, and they want to be able to engage with you on other levels as well. And I think that's something you do really successfully with this film, is you're telling a story, but you're really giving insight to yourself and sharing something about your own journey, and that's what people will tap into.
And that's the thing. Do you think that, you know, now that you're starting to see a little bit of this PR and there's so many people that are interested in the story, does that feel like there's a form of success that's come from that, from success of the story, that I'm telling a good story, that people want to hear this story?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Especially because I'm so close to the film and it's about me, you lose all subjectivity. You lose all the objectivity. And so you sit there thinking, God, is this any good? Or even if technically you feel that the film's been put together well, you think, is anyone going to give a shit about this? I mean, I'm not a famous person. I'm just Tom.
Yeah.
Is anyone going to connect to this and really want to watch it all the way through? You know, so to have the interest in it that I was, I suppose, correct in thinking that people would just engage with the authenticity of it or the honesty in it, which was what I was hoping.
Yeah, validation of that.
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. Yeah.
Great.
And I think it's really interesting. There's a section in the film where you talk to your sister about what you want to achieve with the film.
Well, yeah.
And it's not that you guys have a conversation about, you can only tell your story. You can't
Yeah, control. It's out of my control.
Yeah.
Oh, guys, I grapple with that daily, even now. You have no idea. It's an ongoing process of having to let go of the outcome for me. Constantly having to let go of the outcome. Because essentially you go through this process for what? You go through it all because you want to do it because you love it. Yep. But you want to get it out there. And essentially what you're doing, you're crossing over into a whole other line, aren't you, into the getting it out there and will the audience like it? That's a whole other avenue of or part of this process. And what you're essentially doing is you're rolling the dice and trying to, and when you make yourself really vulnerable, or having made myself very vulnerable, it's easier said than done than just going, okay, let it go now. It's up to the universe. It is a constant spiritual push-ups, emotional push-ups of having to let it go. Just let it go. It's going to be fine. It's up to the universe. Honestly.
Spiritual push-ups. I think that imagery.
We totally understand that as well, Lauren, with what we do as well with performance. It is about letting it go. There's got to be a point where you just let it go. You can't have this thing over you all the time saying, will people like what I've done in that show or what I've done with that choice? You've got to let it go. You go crazy, right?
Yes, absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
So can we talk about what inspires you, or what, on the back of having made that film and realised what you realised through the process, what inspires you now? What do you next want to investigate?
Well, I'm actually writing a movie at the moment called The Box of Tapes, right, which is an idea I had. It's fiction. Fiction's where my heart and soul is. And I've just finished the first draft of it. About 10% of it is good. So
just
it's
a finished draft.
Exactly. It's supposed to be like that. So anyway, but it's an idea that I've had since I was 18 years old, and it really explores the discrepancy between our self-image and how we're perceived. And do people tell us the truth? That's what it's all about. It's I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but it's really about this guy who's you'll find some resonances here. This guy whose relationships are in tatters, and the universe conspires to teach him a lesson. So yeah, I really like the idea of taking big concepts and picking them apart and looking at the microcosm of the emotional experience of what we actually go through day to day. About, you know, getting over these little hurdles. You know, the emotional push-ups I was just talking about, Nick. You know, what is that? Yeah. What is that to do that, to actually let it go and go through that, angst, okay, I have to do something in order to let go of that angst and be comfortable and free. Does that make sense?
Yeah. This expression on my face is me just thinking about exactly what you're saying, that idea of, you know, you go through a difficult point and what you learn in that projects you into the next. I love this push-up idea.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's nothing new story-wise, but it's just that's what I like to focus on. I really like the microcosm, which is why it's the same in the doco. It's a microcosm of that experience.
And it's funny, Lauren, you used the terminology relentless investigation when we spoke to Natasha Pincus as well, but I think it relates perfectly to you, Thomas, as far as, you know, you're always exploring these ideas and hopefully you find something new every time you explore them, and they interest you because of that, I think.
And it's interesting, something else she said about what drives her is this idea when she has a story she wants to tell, she needs to tell it because she's the only one who can tell it that way.
Yeah.
And that really seems to resonate with the stuff that you're doing too, this microcosm idea and the detail.
Mm. And I think that's why, this is the thing. I don't know why everyone's so bloody competitive in the entertainment industry, because everyone has something so specific and different to offer. It's a different perspective. So I think there's a place for everybody. You know, everyone's got their own voice, and I want to hear everyone's voice because everyone's voice is different, and I'm hungry for stories. You know what I mean? So I don't understand why there's that competitiveness, but I totally identify with that.
Yeah, and when you just said, oh, you know, it's not a new story, but it is, because it's through your perspective.
Precisely,
correct.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so exciting.
Oh, there you go. Look at that.
Well, I was really interested to ask this question because I think this is going to be a really interesting answer from you. I would love for you to just look down the barrel of the Skype camera, because this is how I know you, through the barrel of a camera, and just tell me what the next 5 years looks like for Thomas Meadmore. What is it bringing?
Oh, Nick.
This is why I loved it, because I knew you would answer this so honestly and so truthfully and really think about it.
Well, I don't know. See, this is kind of going against everything I'm trying to do at the moment, which is let go. So, you know, I tell you what, my fantasy world, do you want my fantasy world response?
Let's do that. Let's do that.
So my ideal response would be...
Let's put this out to the universe.
Okay, this is a declaration to the universe. Okay, the next 5 years would see a wonderfully successful film festival run for the documentary How to Lose Jobs, Nailing That Girlfriends, that would lead to terrific meeting wonderful other filmmakers and creatives that I could collaborate with on future projects as well, including the feature film The Box of Tapes, which by that stage I will have finished writing and will be just the best it can possibly be. I will have made another 30 Inner Fangirl films because they are so much fun, and that will be generating income for me if the documentary or the feature film hasn't already done so. I will still be with my beautiful French girlfriend Claire, and we will either be living in Australia, London, or, I mean, who knows, America. I don't see myself going to America to live, but I didn't see myself coming to London, so never say never. And I will be working full-time in some capacity as a filmmaker, as a director. I'm currently employed full-time as an editor, and I would very much like to make that transition over to directing and making my own films. So the next 5 years sees that perfect fantasy scenario playing out.
Well, I hope it all comes true, mate. I hope it all comes true, because it sounds great.
It does sound great, doesn't it? It sounds fucking great.
Make it happen now, mate. Go out there and make it happen.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're well on your way.
Thanks, Lauren.
Oh, it's been so exciting to be here with you so early this morning.
It's been great. Thanks so much for having me on your show. Like, it's really, really nice, really cool that you guys would be so interested. So thanks.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having us. Any last words? Any advice for artists around the world?
I think it's just a case of, like I said before, you know, and I'm no expert, but I think the only thing that we can do is just keep going. You know, just keep going.
Okay, so much to take from that, Nick.
Amazing, wasn't it? I really enjoyed it. A totally different vibe again. I keep saying that, but we just get different vibes from the different storytellers, and that's, as Thomas was speaking about it, that's what makes every story unique.
And I actually just want to get all of them in a room together and talk to them for hours instead of just this.
There we go. There's the live show, Lauren. We have everyone come into a room and we do like a, I don't know, what do they do? They do on The Bachelor or whatever. Everyone gets a rose and they get to talk.
And we hired Thomas to edit it for us. Yeah. Which he may not really appreciate because he wants to be a filmmaker and not an editor. Right, what am I saying? So, I mean, that got me thinking about so many things, and it's 8:30 in the morning and I'm now very awake. But something that really got me excited probably a third of the way through the interview, when he was talking about why he want to finish the film,
mm-hmm.
when it, you know, it got to the point where things were really challenging, and he said, if I stop, I'm never going to finish anything.
Yeah.
And I think that really, I know I say resonated a lot, but I think that really resonated with me, because that's, I feel that way a lot. When I was in Bali and I was, everyone knows what a personal challenge it was for me climbing the volcano there.
Yeah.
When I got 5% from the top and I just wanted to die. And I thought to myself, if I stop this, if I don't make it to the top, then I feel like I'm never going to make it where I want to make it in my acting career.
Yeah.
And I just, which, you know, is putting a lot of pressure on myself, but I think that's what we do as artists.
Totally.
It has to be that important for us to do what we do.
And I think we're very similar, Lauren, in that sense that we do tend to take on a lot in our day-to-day lives, whether it be projects or whether it be our relationships or whatever it may be, right? And one of those things is when you can take on a lot, you tend to not finish projects. And that was certainly something that, in my life a couple of years ago, I had to really stop and go, well, you know what? Are you just going to half do stuff, or are you actually going to commit to something properly? And it's one of those things, and it's actually brought up, it's a very key theme, I would have thought, in Tom's film as well. This idea of, well, are you going to commit to be the best that you can be, or are you going to quit?
Oh, wow. But yeah, in the film, you know, not just looking at Tom make that decision, but seeing all three artists in the film make that decision.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I mean, just off the top of that, I think that takeout's fantastic, but I love this idea of mental push-ups. Isn't that cool? This idea that you've just constantly got to do that and constantly just got to almost keep telling yourself certain things, exercise the brain to make sure that you stay in a healthy mindset and also can let go of things.
Well, I think they feed really nicely into each other, because when you get to the point where you are asking yourself, why should I keep going? And you make the decision, I can't stop now. Like, that is the push-up, right?
Yeah, or one of, that's exactly
one of
right.
many.
Lauren, I absolutely love this guy's perspective on creativity and honesty. It is so raw, but it comes across so well.
Oh, yes. It's the standard that he drives in, you know, like the absolute honesty and taking responsibility for your flaws. And yes, that's a lot to think about.
My month, Lauren, can I tell you a little bit about that?
Yes, do.
You know what
I've got? Tell me about your month, Nick.
Please, thank you. I am going back to film a web series called My PT, which was Ooh. Originally a pilot for a TV show that didn't end up getting picked up, but the guy who wrote it is creating a web series. And the idea of the series is called My PT, which stands for My Personal Trainer, and it's all based in a fitness studio. And yep. the different characters that you have in the fitness studio. I will be reprising my role as Daz, the boyfriend of one of the trainers who is absolutely bonkers crazy. So I'm looking forward to that. Bit of comedy.
Typecast again.
I know, right? It's just so me. As well as that, as you knew, I was doing radio, so we've now been bumped to breakfast, which is a good thing. Not bumped in a bad way, bumped to breakfast. So we're doing two shows a week, which is a really great new challenge. And it gives us more opportunity.
So
yeah, it gives us more opportunity to create a more rounded show because we've got more time.
A bit more continuity.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then I'm using the rest of the time to reconnect with my family and friends, Lauren, because I haven't seen them for a long time.
Yeah, well, I'll be back in a few days and doing the same thing, hopefully.
One of those friends that I do need to catch up with. So.
Oh, catching up with you too. Yeah, sorry, yeah. I meant my family.
Oh, okay. So on that note, what's about your month, Lauren? What's it going to bring?
So obviously so much has happened over here and has given me heaps to think about and take on board, and I've met so many amazing people. And I think one of the great things about this podcast is it's really inspired me to really ask questions of the people I meet and find out about what makes them tick and what they're doing and what drives them. So I'm taking all that home with me, and I will be shooting my first role in a feature film over the next month.
That's exciting.
So I meant
straight back into the country into a feature.
It is very exciting. So this is the feature that I got cast in, late last year. I've talked about it in earlier podcasts. Uh-huh. It's all up and running. Indie film ETK, Experience the Knowing. It's a micro-budget supernatural thriller about a troubled white-collar exec who goes on a journey through the afterlife.
Wow.
And the exec is being played by Dean Kirkwright, who's not only a wonderful guy, but who just starred opposite Tara Reid in Australian horror film director Chris Sun's third feature, Charlie's Film.
I did see that. He's doing quite a lot, that boy, isn't he?
He's doing a good lot. I mean, it's a fantastic cast. We've got Rain Fuller. You know, there's...
Yes.
They've got me.
Lucky them.
But I think one of the most exciting things is the whole cast and crew on the project are really lovely and talented. Yeah. So it's great to be part of that.
Fantastic.
And my other goal over the next few months is to work on bringing a healthier structure to my daily schedule. So I'm trying to, you could, yeah, maybe we can work on this together.
We work on this together. This can be a team effort. That's a fantastic way to put it. A healthier structure. Is that what you said? A healthier structure of your life schedule?
Healthier structure to my daily schedule.
Okay, daily schedule.
So I want to really tap in, you know, when you come back from, you finish a project or you come back from a journey and you have that sense of a new beginning. I want to make the most of that opportunity to, yeah, to try and get more structure, as I said. One of our listeners, Melbourne actor Jamie Hansen, wrote us an email recently, and he was really interested in our journeys as artists and, mm-hmm. and how we manage that. You know, I'm a full-time artist now, mm-hmm. and how I choose to focus my time. So I've obviously been thinking about that a lot recently. And when I finished working full-time, I thought I would have all, I've talked about this before, but I thought I would have all this time, but instead I've been, I love what I do, so I find it really easy to justify putting work first.
Mm.
But, you know, where are the boundaries?
Yeah, where's the balance?
And of course, yeah, and of course working on things constantly isn't necessarily the most efficient way of getting things done.
No,
amen. So in an email from Jamie, he talks about how it can be wonderful being 100% accountable for your own time, also scary, and I think he's right. And I've been discovering that in my excitement, I tend to realize a number of things I'd like to be working on, and I just try to do everything at once.
Hmm.
So, yeah, so I'm grappling with all of that.
I think it'd be great if next month you share a little bit of what comes out of that too, Lauren, because, and I know you will, but I think that's very interesting to a lot of people. Like, I was just hearing you say that then and go, wow, how do you find that balance? And you know, is it one step at a time? Like, what are the different things that you can implement to help you get back to that? Because I'm a bit like you too, in the sense of you want to do everything, but it's not always the best way to work or the best way to get the most out of yourself. So, I don't know if whether it's just learnings that you find next month, but I'm interested to see how that goes with you.
Well, I'd definitely be happy to talk about it if I make any discoveries, which hopefully I do. But, you know, I did a course at the Actors Centre in London mm-hmm. with this great guy, Darren R.L. Gordon, mm-hmm. for anyone who wants to look him up, on target setting and career progression. And, you know, he talks about how as an actor you need to have a constant sense of your objectives and a strong awareness of how effectively you're progressing towards them, I think there's something really important. You know, I feel like I do so much and I feel very busy, but I lose sight of how far I'm moving forward and in which direction I'm moving.
And what are the most effective actions that you can take to get where you want to go with your objectives?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So, Lauren, do you have any recommendations for this month? What's going on in the next month that you can give us the hot tip on?
Given that I've been over here and I feel like I've been researching the LA, New York and London industries in some way, I guess I'd just like to give a plug to podcasts. You know, I mentioned listen to Anne Suya's podcast, Another Aussie in LA, that was recently sponsored by Australians in Film over here. And, you know, all of the Australians that she's talking to are people who have either made the transition permanently or are coming over here to visit to figure out how to make it work. And there's just a minefield of information in those interviews. So I think that's going to be my recommendation.
Oh, it's a good one too, because you always have been a massive fan of podcasts, and you really did get me into listening to them now. Like, I love binging on podcasts these days of the stuff that you find. So thanks for that. I think I might need to go see a therapist about that. But
well, I keep talking to people here. They keep recommending new ones. So I now have a whole heap of new ones to listen to. So maybe just every month I'll recommend a new podcast.
I thought you were recommending therapists, not podcasts, but that's fine.
A whole list of therapists. You can put that list together for me.
Yeah, exactly. I'll pass it on. I do have a recommendation for this month, if I can, Lauren. Yes, you can. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. I have a great little event, a really random little event called I'll Be Your Mirror, which is happening in Sydney. It's called A Knitted Tribute to Lou Reed, which, if you know Lou Reed, was the singer of the Velvet Underground back in the day. A lot of artists consider Velvet Underground the band that really inspires them as far as rock and roll music. Now, Lou passed recently, but there's a great little knitted tribute, which there's a story behind it, and stick with me here. When Lou Reed toured Australia for the first time in August 1974, a woman from Sydney wearing a Transformer sweater, Transformer was the album that they had released, attended his first press conference. Lou Reed actually found who this woman was and sent the following message to her. It said, "I've decided not to sue, and I would like to order 20. So when the band next performed, they all had these Transformer sweaters on. And so this same lady has actually done a tribute of knitted jumpers and scarves to Lou Reed. And it's been extended by popular demand. It was only on the 10th of September, but it's now running right through to the 20th of September. So if you are in Sydney, look it up. It's called I'll Be Your Mirror, A Knitted Tribute to Lou Reed.
That's fantastic. Where did you hear about that?
I just, through my sources. But it's okay, worth checking out.
I won't ask any more questions.
Yeah, that's right.
I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you.
That's exactly right.
Well, Nick, it has been so lovely to see your face on Skype.
Aw, ditto. Good to see you, and hurry home.
Yes. So until, well, golly, I guess this month's been a bit late, so it's only a few more weeks until our next podcast. But until then, you can find us on the usual channels, about.me, Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, iTunes. And I promise, our website, it really is coming soon, hopefully by next month. So watch out for that.
And continue to join us next month on The Act of Storytelling.
Thanks for listening.